You're on the record.
Good morning. Julie, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right. Well, welcome to Wednesday morning's June 29th ADA board meeting. I will call the meeting to order and ask for Amy to do a roll call of board members.
Commissioner Sandy?
Here.
Mr. Ellis?
Here.
Mr. Pendig?
Here.
Mr. Fogel?
He's absent.
Mr. Buglemar?
Here.
Mr. Mitchell?
Here.
Chair Bruce?
Here.
Also, Mr. Fogel, our president.
Thank you. Our next is our agenda approval. If you've had a chance to take a look at it, any suggestions for deletions, additions? Alan, do you have anything?
Chair, nothing from our side.
All right. I'll take a motion.
I move the agenda as presented.
Second. Any objections to the agenda as presented? Hearing and seeing none, our agenda is approved. Brings us to item number 4, 5 minutes for May 25th, 2022. Some board members have had a chance to review the minutes. Any clarifications, corrections, additions?
I move the prior minutes as presented.
Second. Any objections to adopt the minutes as presented? Hearing and seeing none, our minutes are adopted. Next up is public comments. Ask everybody for limited 2 minutes. And I'd like to make sure we get your name on the record and any affiliation if you should have one. Randy, do we have anybody online? And then with that, how do they know when it's their turn to talk? So make sure that everybody understands that.
Sorry, Chair, but we're having a little technical difficulty linking with the party that wants to speak at this point. If you give us a just
absolutely, if the times need to.
When you call in, when you call in, you will enter the teleconference as needed. After the board call, please press star 9 and announce your name clearly, and we will bring your call in. Thank you. Sir, there's no public comment at this time.
Okay. Anybody in the boardroom wishing to make a public comment? Hearing none, I guess we'll close that comment session. Randy, if they come back on, would you let me know? All right. We'll move on to new business. Item number 6A, Resolution G22-07, Hex Cook LLC. Alan?
Thank you, Chair. Board members, we have before you Resolution number G2207, which is a resolution on the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority approving amendments to a loan agreement with Hex Cook Inlet LLC and co-borrowers. So attached to the resolution and what has been linked to the public agenda is a copy of the resolution itself, but also a board memorandum, which is from staff explaining the changes that we're looking to modify within the loan agreement, as well as giving the basis that we believe supports the modifications in place. We also are being joined by John Hendricks and parts of his management team to also be able to answer any questions that the board members may have about their request. They've also prepared a presentation that they would like to go through with you. At this time, I'd like to ask if John Hendricks would join me at the table to ultimately review that presentation, which has also been provided to the public. Before we get into the presentation itself, what I would like to identify just a little bit of background for the board and for the public is ADA approved, really the board approved a resolution in 2020 which established a $7.5 million loan which was facilitating Hex Cook Inlet's acquisition of Fury Operating and other entities which had the leases for the kitchen lights unit. Since that point in time, John Hendricks and his management team have been operating the kitchen light units and producing natural gas that has benefited Cook Inlet, natural gas users, largely within Anchorage and also Kenai Peninsula. They have benefited through the ADA's mission of job growth and economic development by really retaining Alaska-trained professional staff, upwards of 21 members at this point in time within their organization. So largely an Alaska-based operation at this point, operating the development and production of natural gas in the Cook Inlet, as well as contributing taxes to the Kenai Borough and state at about roughly $1.6 million a year, and also benefiting in large part natural gas production and diversity for the broader Cook Inlet Basin area. So at this point, and with that summary, we'd like to ask John if he could join us and really walk through the presentation and their operations for you.
Good morning. And first and foremost, thank you for getting us in business. We've got to reflect back to the time when you asked for loans and you're trying to acquire this company that, ADA was the only hope that we really had, and thanks to your courage, and because you've been probably had some missteps before in the oil and gas industry, it was tough to pull off, but we did it thanks to your management team and the board. So I thank you. On that note, if you look at it, oil and gas is like the alpha energy economic mover in the state. The budget that was just approved, the governor, was because of oil and gas and what oil prices have done for our state. So hopefully, through our efforts and your efforts, we can break the barrier where Alaskans will be able to see that we don't need solely outside influence to invest in our resource, but we can do it ourselves. And that's what our company's number one mission is, to show Alaskans can run oil and gas companies. Thank you. Okay. Next one. So, can we go to the presentation size? Or that is the presentation size. Okay, next slide. There we go. Here's our structure. We're pretty overcomplicated, but that's what we inherited to acquire Fury Operating Alaska, which operates the kitchen light unit, is we had to basically purchase Corsair and Cornucopia that owned that. And so Hex Cook Inlet at the time was formed. So that's the parent company over there. I do have one company called Hex that's over that. And we could talk about that too if you want. Next.
Hi, everybody.
You're fast. We sell, like a previous slide says, we sell to every utility in the South Central region of Alaska. And one thing after bankruptcy that we can be proud to say is recently NSTAR came out with a new rate change hike, and it showed that our price was even 50 cents lower than a newcomer out of North Fork for gas for MCF. So, and that has been true since we began. So once we recovered this company, all those contracts basically with NSTAR remained in place, and the consumers from our pricing received gas at 50 cents less a day. Here's the kitchen lights unit, as you see. It's the largest acreage position of 83,000. And I'll go ahead, a little step ahead there to say where it says area-wide boundary. We acquired stuff just north of there between it and C in the 2021 lease sale. And then we filled in the gaps around that platform on the map with some additional lease sales in this last year. Next. So Alaskans benefiting from Hex ownership. Like I said, we're locally owned. We're 100% Alaskan-owned company. The Hex team invested in the success of Alaska. We're here to stay because we're Alaskans. And the acquisition has facilitated with ADA. Let's see. Can't hardly make that out. Sorry. So the company saved from bankruptcy and continued to, there we go, thank you. Contributes to Alaska economy and people, supports the good jobs, economic growth. We've gone from basically, if you remember, only one Alaskan employee to now that we have 23 full paid employees in the state of Alaska. And I think that's showing in basically the local economy down there of what we've done, that we want to participate, and we continue to support nonprofits in the area, kids in the area, schools in the Homer, Nikiski, and Kenai area. State benefits from royalties of 12.5%, property tax is 20 mils, and we're further burdened, which is a very difficult thing for us, of another 12.5% to overrise, in which the state of Alaska is awarded to others. So that's one of the challenges for us. 25% right off the top goes out of our pocket to manage our business. But that's good. Some of it goes to the state.
I could highlight just a little bit of a background. This is Alan Weissner. Really to identify the fact of this operation was in bankruptcy. John Hendricks and his management team came in, acquired it out of bankruptcy, made it into an operating entity, which has contributed over $7.5 million to the state through that royalty payment obligation. So just really want to identify that to the board as well with the benefits that came from the actions taken by Ada and working with John Hendricks and his team.
We're also on the bottom there is the DRNR, this is the abandonment. We set up a sinking fund in which currently 10 cents of every molecule of gas that comes out of the Beluga Formation goes into the sinking fund for abandonment, and 20 cents from the Sterling. Currently, there's about $850,000 in the state coffers for that. We also have a set-aside account for further abandonment if needed. But that's what we have right now. Next. That's just a picture of where we've gone with employment. How we can, the main thing is look at the graph on the far left, where there's non-residents on the blue, dark blue, and residents on the light blue. These are full employed workers, FTEs. And then look to the right, where it's completely the opposite. I don't think you'll find any other company that has done that in the last 2 years. And we did this during bankruptcy. Not the bank, put out of the end during COVID. You got to remember, we took over this in July of 2020. We didn't hardly qualify for anything as far as job growth because of COVID, because they didn't have any employees, and we built it. There's nothing in the COVID rules that said, if you grow from 1 to 20 employees during COVID, you get benefits. No.
All he had to do is keep the 20 employed, you'd get benefits. Next. This here shows our contracting where it says he is.
As we're going through the slide, could you tell us the difference between firm and non-firm contract?
Firm and non-firm means we're committed with penalties on firm. Non-firm is we avoid penalties, very simply. We have fixed rates that we have to deliver for a certain amount. If we don't deliver it, we pay. Fury went in the bank. Go ahead.
What would those penalties be, just for instance?
They would be, we have to provide the same gas for the same price. So we'll have to go buy it from somebody else. Fury went bankrupt because of that clause, because they tried to produce the Sterling Formation, which is still an unproved source of gas that we're trying to prove. And they put it online. They were making 2,000 barrels of water a day and froze the pipeline up. It cost the company $17 million in penalties to reimburse Instar for this. Yeah. And as we manage our company, we try to avoid contracts that obligate us to those kind of penalties. Okay, next. So, again, we acquired the company on 6/30/20, and this is basically our second year anniversary, starting tomorrow, my mom's birthday, and it's the last. It's all Alaska ownership and management, and we're the only company to participate in the 2022 lease sale here recently. We're securing up the boundaries around the drillable areas around our platform. Also, one thing that's not on this slide is that we were the highest bidder of all Cook Inlet leases in 2021. We picked some other acreage up under Hex and Hex Cook Inlet to basically diversify our portfolio. Benefits for Alaska, jobs, economy, gas, heat, and power. So often we forget the essentials of life. Contributing dollars to the state and local governments through property taxes, jobs, and royalties. Environmental stewardship and operational excellence. We've been trying to establish ourselves as a very diligent, responsible player in the Cook Inlet, and a locally owned operator that's not out of Canada, not out of the lower 48, not from a foreign country, not from a foreign continent, but right here, homegrown in our state of Alaska. Financially healthy, we have our CFO, Kevin Hemingway, and our controller over here, Michael Cipriano. They'll tell you that we're equivalent to a AA-rated company right now, if you'd look at our numbers. And charitable giving and sponsorships, I grew up in Homer. I believe in trying to help people that need and where we can do it. And the more unbridled we get with restrictions on us, the more we can help, and the more we grow, and the more we invest in our state, so there should be more to come. We also provide a great competition and diversity of gas supply to the Upper Cook Inlet. As everybody knows, Hillcorp's very, very large. They're 85% plus. We're hanging around 6%. We'd like to get to 10%. We'd like to be the new Alaskan Hillcorp in the future. And improve our footprint and provide more gas to Alaska and surety of gas to the homes. One thing I want to make you aware that I try to always, since I bought this company, I was not aware of that, how Henry Hub and our prices play out at the home meters. But we, Alaskans pay more for gas than they used to. Okay, now they're paying 9 in Brent, lower 48, and we're paying about 7. But it used to be $2 for Henry Hub in the lower 48, and we were charging $6.50. But the problem is, that's at the wellhead. That's not at the homes. Because we're close to proximity, the Alaskans are only paying about $10.50 for the gas at the meter. Where 2 years ago, even the state of Mississippi and Texas, they were paying $11 plus. We were playing below average, and right now, with the lower 48 price spike, gas at the meter in some place in the lower 48 is going to be pushing 20. And we Alaskans, we kind of have an island economy, so it's good and bad, but it's there. And that's how it works, because we don't have to go through multiple transporters to get our product to the home meters. Okay. Next. There's our Julius R platform. It's the newest platform in Cook Inlet. We have also our shore facility is new. We were very fortunate to pick up, but it was very overbuilt for what was designed. I mean, there's only four wells in this platform, and we have to operate a platform, a flow line, and a shore facility. We can handle more, but we need to grow more, and we need to prove up the resources that are under that ground and then around us. And our future plans is to continue to, you know, this is mostly focused to you on the kitchen lights, but we'd like to have Ada as our future partner going forward in other opportunities. We just finished a subsurface survey. Go ahead and go down. I don't think it shows it. In the Cook Inlet, where we spent about eight, nine months on it, it should be concluding in the next 30 days. And from that, we'll know what the highest rated drillable targets are under the kitchen lights around that platform within a 3-mile radius. And we'll be putting a plan together to drill that. We would like to have Ada continue to be a partner when that comes out. We're also looking at some other opportunities on land, and we might be bringing those to have you guys look at in the future also if you're interested. But that would be a facility development also. But right now, our company is doing the best we can to represent you and Alaska as a responsible oil and gas company in our state.
Thanks, John.
Mr. Chairman.
Randy.
John, how many more slots do you have on the platform?
We have two more slots, and we can also sidetrack the existing wellbores.
So could you go back to that third slide that showed your acreage position and tell us how that overlays the kitchen lights as it's defined?
Okay. Go back to that one, other one, the yellow one. There you go. All right. So that's the kitchen lights unit right there you see in yellow. And we filled in the gaps to the, see those two dots right in the center under the platform?
Yes.
So we filled in the gaps to the left and the right of that, those two dots, by buying acreage. And it's a 3-mile radius of those right now from the platform. The platform's under that center dot, that's kind of center in that yellow block, is where the platform is. And we can drill within 3 miles outside of that radius, maybe even 5 miles outside that radius.
Thank you, John.
Yeah.
Thanks, Chair.
Couple quick things. The questions I have, but I want to make sure everybody else has questions. So, first question is does Hex have any of the loans related?
This is the only loan that we have in place is what was approved under Resolution G2007. So for the initial balance of $7.5 million, there's already been a pay down under that loan of a little over $5 million. So there's a balance, a little bit in excess of $2 million, which is outstanding at this point. Then there's as I'm being reminded, there's an affiliated loan with an office building that we did under the loan participation program, which is directly to John Hendricks, a property company that he owns, which supports the office for Hex Cook Inlet, but it's not directly related to the loan that we've made to Hex Cook Inlet itself.
Oh, okay. So is Hex in the building that we own?
They are the principal lessee. Yes.
Okay. All right. And then for the record, would you mind stating so this is a loan modification?
We're requesting an amendment to the existing loan. And what we're looking to do, and that's highlighted in the memorandum, there's two specific reasons for it. We're looking to, under the structure that we put in place initially with the loan, we have a cash sweep, which is related to the excess cash flow that's generated by Hex Cook Inlet and its underlying subsidiaries, which is done on a quarterly basis. And with that, that is the principal reason why we have the payment profile that we're identifying to the board at this point in time. So with the initial balance of $7.5 million and a set amortization that was structured over 5 years, we have had a cash sweep that have really brought forward the principal repayment on the loan. So at this point in time, what John and his team are requesting is the ability to start accumulating some capital for the further investment in the Cook Inlet and natural gas deposits and production, which we as staff support. So from our standpoint, in reviewing the financial information that's been provided by ex-Cook Inlet and their subsidiaries, again, provided under a confidential basis under our confidentiality statute, which is 4488215. In our analysis, the existing term out of the loan as originally presented is sufficient to meet the requirements of the full payout under the loan. So we're requesting to waive that cash sweep at this point in time. The secondary point of the amendment to the loan agreement is related to certain tax payments that need to be made by Hex Cook Inlet LLC under their corporate structure. And I think it may be worthwhile, John, if you gave a bit of an explanation on why that particular request is needed.
Yes. I can't take a distribution. I can't take distribution to pay my income tax under the current ballot set up. I might make the company has $5 million in income. It shows up on my tax record, but I can't use it to pay my taxes because you've handcuffed me. And so...
Well, it's in general the structure with it. In taking it out of bankruptcy, there are other secondary lenders that were involved in the structure on this. And if there are restrictions that are put in place on distributions that come out of the company for specific purposes. With the original restructure of the loan out of bankruptcy, one of the elements that was not included, which should have been included, and is a normal undertaking in a loan agreement, is to allow for the current corporate tax structure to be accommodated. Because the Hex-Cook Inlet is a limited liability company, you have John Hendricks, ultimately as the principal party that's responsible for that LLC and the distributions, it becomes his tax obligation based upon certain receipts that come to the underlying companies. So what we're looking to do is make sure that there's amendments put in place in the loan agreement that allow for the company to cover its tax obligations ultimately through the principal responsible party, which is John Hendricks.
Okay. Go ahead.
This is Devin. And so I had a conversation with Kevin immediately preceding the meeting. First of all, I think that the project obviously is hitting on all cylinders, that Mike, you've highlighted Alaska Hire, state benefits, energy security. I think you undersold local benefit, the connectedness to borough, both by employees that likely live in that region, as well as sales tax and property tax that they benefit from. But the current budget includes significant funding for prior tax credit, cash flow credits, that I believe some of which are attributable to the company that you acquired, and the benefit that those might have in freeing up some of the restrictions that you otherwise are under because of the pre-bankruptcy filings. And so that, I think, in combination with what the board's considering today, could be an additional benefit to allow you to more flexibility in the future as we move forward. And so that's just...
We are hoping that the budget goes smoothly and the tax credits are paid. However, this company that we acquired had a little cloud under it. The state it has not answered us if they're done doing audits. And if the audit is delayed, that delays me from being unencumbered by ING and ECP agreements. And we've made calls to certain parties, and we have not received They've had a year to finish the audit, and our biggest fear is that it will be they will continue to kick the can down the road another year, which is not good for us as far as getting our other creditors, ING and ECP. And the whole underlying thing is we don't want you guys to sweep us and ING and ECP be the prime. That's the whole thing, is we can pay you off. We'd gladly pay you off. I think it's good to have a good relationship with Ada and to have you as the first. But I don't want ECP and ING jumping into first position. But we, tax credits, we've been waiting 5 years for those to be paid or more. We think that it should be paid immediately. If they're not paid immediately, since the governor approved it, the state owes us 11% interest every day they delay. We didn't do that last year. The ING and ECP received $12 million. The state of Alaska, 45 days they delayed before they released them. They said, well, you're still holding those other taxes. At least make a payment. And that cost me $3,000 a day for 45 days because they did not release and pay ECP and ING. And I didn't hold this state accountable for that. We let that ride. But this year we will not.
So if I may clarify from Ada's position in the loans, what was just expressed.
A little color to it.
So based on what John just expressed, again, from Ada's position, we do not benefit from any payment of oil tax credits by the state to Hex Cook Inland, its underlying subsidiaries, and what those outstanding obligations were when John and his team brought that out of bankruptcy or bought the company out of bankruptcy. We have a loan that's directly related to the underlying subsidiaries that's based upon current production of natural gas and the sales of that natural gas within the Cook Inlet region. Based upon that analysis and the initial loan in place and the terms, we do support the amendment to remove the cash sweep because we believe that there's sufficient gas resources and a payment profile that will be recognized over the remaining term of the debt. Any benefit that comes from the tax payments is an issue really related with the terms of the acquisition that were necessary with existing creditors.
Alan, so just to put it on the record, this tax been is it a good loan, properly paid, properly on time?
The performance by John Hendricks, his team, particularly I want to identify the financial team that's been responding on a quarterly basis, full performance under the terms of the loans that we put in place, as well as with the co-lenders and the full structure. So from our standpoint, there has been full compliance. The initial structure has fully worked. Every payment has been provided on time.
All right. So that being said, John, I appreciate that information. I would ask that the board go into executive session to discuss confidential information.
So for the board, just be aware, we do have financial information that is provided to us on a quarterly basis. That is subject to our confidential statute 4488215, as well as per the terms of the underlying loan agreement that's been provided under a confidential basis. So if there's any specific questions on that information, we would need to have a confidential meeting on that.
This is Bill Kinnon. I move that the board enter an executive session to discuss confidential financial information. This is supported by the Open Meetings Act, which allows the board to consider confidential matters in an executive session. The discussion of these subjects would have an adverse effect upon the finances of Ada and or protected by law.
Bill Bibblemore, I second. Is there any objection to going to executive session? Hearing seeing none, it should not take long, and we'll be in executive session. We'll wait for Randy.
Chair, you are live.
I would advise that the board did not take any action on the matters discussed while in executive session, other than to provide instruction to counsel. Really? Take any action on the matters discussed while in executive session other than discuss confidential financial information of that. Okay. So we are back in our back to the agenda. We have resolution G22-07 hex cook inlet on the table. I will entertain a motion.
Chair, Board Member Goodlamore, I move resolution number G2207 as presented.
This is Bill Kindig. I second.
Discussion to the resolution. Any discussion? Can you hear us, Julie? Comments from our...
Yeah, I can hear you guys. Thank you. Nothing from me other than I do really appreciate the presentation, both from Mr. Hex and then of course all of the work that the staff has done. They've done a really thorough job in the presentations of the board today, so I appreciate all of that and all of the information. I also, in the presentation, want to highlight when we approved this, you know, years ago, the board asked or requested pretty directly that we see improvement or real direction in terms of demonstrating Alaskan-based employment. We recognize that all of the value that those folks bring to the state and to their individual communities, not just through their wages, but also through the ways in which they interact in the community and provide community service. So I just really appreciate the presentation. I appreciate how much focus this company has done in terms of providing Alaskan-based hire and those full-time jobs. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. Without further discussion, Wendy, I will entertain and poll the board.
Commissioner Sandy?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Kendrick?
Yes.
Mr. Fogel? Mr. Beavermore?
Yes.
Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
Chair Cruz?
Yes.
Mr. Pat?
Thank you. Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Hex team, Morgan. It brings us to item number B on our agenda under new business, G22-08, home property maintenance and civil site improvements. Alan?
Chair, board members, what we have before you is resolution number G2208, which is the resolution of the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority approving funding for building, maintenance, and civil improvements to include parking lot reconfiguration, repairs, paving, and exterior site improvements. Attached to the resolution is a memorandum from our staff and also looking at I've asked Curtis Thayer, AEA Executive Director, to also join us for discussion about the building improvements. So what we are looking to do is summarize the improvements that we are looking to undertake within the building. These improvements have been outstanding for quite a while. I would like to present really towards the board. We have attached to this a summary presentation, which is giving our initial budget estimates for the specific work that we're looking to undertake. In aggregate, we're talking about effectively $1.16 million to be expensed over this current fiscal year and the next fiscal year to undertake these improvements. But in stating that number, what I do want to highlight is that there are current appropriations that have been previously approved by the board, which includes resolutions G1515, resolutions G1903, and resolutions G1907, which in aggregate represent a little over $500,000, which remains unexpended under those resolutions for related building improvements. Additionally, we have allocations under G2126 of a full balance of $275,000, which we would also be applying to this. So the net position that we're really requesting for the board at this point in time to undertake these civil improvements on the building is effectively a net position, and I will use the approximate number of $400,000, which is what we have in the resolution itself. So that is based upon early estimates and budgets on these numbers. It also includes, and I really do want to highlight, it includes a 20% contingency related to this. We are using a higher contingency under these numbers because of inflation pressures, supply chain issues that we're seeing with the materials and supplies, the goods and services that are related to the work that we're looking to undertake. So we can't ensure that we have, you know, a full tight budget on this. This is the expectations at this point in time, and it certainly may change. It also may improve. A large component is asphalt for the parking lot improvements, which incorporates a lot of cost issues that right now we would have to fully scope out and contract for on the specific crews and timing to give it a defined date. But we're comfortable at the current numbers. So to generally describe what we're proposing as far as the building improvements is principally the parking lot area. Resolution G1515 was adopted by this board to demolish and make room for the Blue Central building, which is adjacent. That's property at 825 Western Northern Lights. That was acquired back in, I believe, in 2013, viewed to be some expansion area, and was ultimately found to be unsuitable for that expansion. That's why the board in 2015 had approved its demolition and making way really for these eventual improvements that we're proposing at this point. So we would be looking to undertake that. Resolutions G1903 and 1907 were addressing work that was required within the building related to the earthquake of November 30, 2018. Those funds were building improvements and reconditioning was undertaken. We also received insurance payments that were utilized for some of those improvements, so there was funding that was available that we're now looking to apply here with these improvements. The building itself, we're talking about adding things that augment the health and safety standards within the building for our staff. So we're talking about additional awnings on the exterior portions of the building to protect during the wintertime. The parking lot improvement is one of those improvements on health and safety for our staff, by ensuring that there's sufficient parking space available on the building side of 27th Avenue, so anyone who's parking in the lots that are across the street aren't going to be required to cross it on a daily basis. Also during the winter when it's a little more challenging. It's in lighting improvements within the parking lot area. It's expanding the area. It's including picnic portions for staff to be able to utilize around the grounds of the building. It's including a monument sign, ultimately for ADA and AEA's signage. I think everyone should be aware that the signs that are attached to the building relate to the initial acquisition back in 2001 of the building, and it's not really the current updated logos or names for the organizations. So it's these types of general improvements that we're looking to propose. We do have a presentation that I'll go ahead and put on the presentation here, which will give you a picture of the parking lot improvements that we're talking about and also some of the other areas, other changes.
Randy, if we could go to the first page, please.
So first off, a little bit of the presentation, what I really want to identify, just as a general reminder to the board, is our mission. So, again, it's to promote, develop, and advance economic growth and diversification in Alaska by providing various means of financing and investment. Ultimately, with every loan, investment, equity investment, a bond underwriting that ADA does, it is invested solely within the state of Alaska. We have driven and directed over $3.5 billion into economic development within Alaska itself, while at the same time providing close to $450 million in dividends that have been declared back to the state for use in the general fund for our social services. So with those investments, it really goes to those two areas. Either it's reinvested into the state of Alaska or it's provided as dividends ultimately to the state. The next slide, please. So this, again, just with every presentation, what we do within ADA, we really try to identify the fact of all loan programs and the projects that we undertake as staff here at ADA. So we have 8 loan programs that are currently operating within the state, from broader conduit revenue bond underwritings, which largely support the health networks within rural and remote Alaska as far as access to health care, to our loan participation program that really provides long-term fixed-rate capital in support of Alaska's commercial real estate sector. On the right side of the presentation is all of the projects that we have invested in or have undertaken, and it's really with a lot of pride I want to highlight that the bottom 8 projects on that list of 17 projects have all been initiated since 2018, 2019 to today. So over half of what we're talking about have really been undertaken as the economy has been broadly challenged, starting in 2018 and through COVID with the economic impact in that place. So we are in the case for Alaska itself. So with AK Ship funding, that program going to Duck Point Development, Hex Cook Inlet, which we just discussed, the SSQ line transaction, which we did with AEA, progressing the full development at this point of the Angler Access Project, the Western Center Road Project, Section 1002, and now with the undertaking of the military facilities on land development in Fairbanks, those have all been initiated very recently and with the support of this board. So in talking about the existing facility, this is a picture really of our current lot and what we are currently working with as the board arrives for different meetings and staff on a daily basis. We have specifically 4 different lots. We have a lot that's right in front of the building itself. We have a lot that's adjacent related to the 825 building. And then across 27th Avenue, we have 2 other distinct lots that are available for our staff parking. Overall, we have 83 PCNs, which with the full inclusion of the last approved positions. We have effectively a need here, requirement under municipality of Anchorage requirements we have to work with, of effectively about 85 to 90 parking lots. We're currently looking at revising what that total number needs to be in concert with code requirements. So what we want to do, this is now the presentation of what the view is of that future parking lot, what we're looking to attain, and that is drastically expanding the parking lot that's in front of the building itself. So that would be available to staff, board members, visitors to the building. It's better presented. It also is within full code, current code of the municipality of Anchorage. So there's expanded landscaping that's going around the entire area. And what is really represented here is with the demolition of the Blue Central Building, that opens up an ability for ingress and egress directly off of Northern Lights Boulevard, which we do not currently have. So, in anyone that's coming to visit the building, as you're well aware, they need to access the building actually off of 27th Avenue, which is sometimes difficult to explain. The timeline that we're talking about is we've already initiated elements of the work that we can under the budget that we have with the $275,000. So So we've initiated the surveys for this year. We're looking at really undertaking some of the initial RFPs that we need to put in place for this work, the current fiscal year. A large amount of the work, as you see, is going to be undertaken during fiscal year 2023 and ultimately into fiscal year 2024 by the state's fiscal year ending in June 30. The completion of the work is anticipated, we identify it here, as September 2023, really within the memorandum itself, what we're identifying is it within the month of October, having everything fully completed of 2023. And that is if we're able to initiate now, with your approval of this budget, initiating for the work to be undertaken. So this is also this is the monument sign that we're looking to put at the corner of Arctic Boulevard and Western Northern Lights Boulevard. So this would be our current logos for ADA and the Alaska Energy Authority. I think in an end within the colors that we currently have, so it's more representative of the organizations. We're additionally putting in place flags up front that would have the Alaska and the U.S. flag that we're flying with the building with the improved landscaping area. And then we're also improving other areas of security around the building. So in all, the proposal we have to you is to really undertake what is effectively a budget of about $1.16 million, a funding request out of the revolving fund of a maximum up to $400,000 to support that budget, and then to be able to really implement all the work that we're looking to undertake to complete that by October 2023.
Thanks, John. Curtis, do you have any comments to make on it?
No, I have no comments. Thank you.
Curtis, do you support the proposal? Yes.
Absolutely, 110%. I gave you cash.
Chairman Cruz.
Go ahead.
I just want to say I really appreciate the staff's patience. I know that ADA is not alone in terms of state funding, and over the last few years there was a lot of deferred and capital projects that have sort of remained on the list, and so I appreciate everybody's patience. But I love this for the, you know, all the ways in which it improves, especially on the safety side of things for staff. And if there's anything else that, you know, we could do, like I was wondering if you could comment just a little bit on the main parking area during the transition, if there are times where visitor parking you guys notice isn't being utilized well, if we could free up some of that visitor parking if needed. I mean, obviously that's at your guys' discretion, but I just wanted to point that out. It would never be the intention of the board to try to hog some of those parking areas. If the only kind of parking lot's full is when we have board meetings, then we'd love for you guys to just be aware that those could be freed up for staff safety. Excuse me. So anyway, I fully support this, and thank you guys very much for the work on it.
Thank you, Julie. Alan, do you have any comments on that?
No, all of it we'd like to recognize is appreciate the support on that side and for the conversations that we've had about these particular improvements. I do identify it's taken a long time to really be able to initiate that. The whole conversation about availability for spots for staff really has come up very recently. We really want to recognize the fact that the support that's there in opening up the spots. We want to make sure that that's also broadly communicated that's going to be available. So the key issue here in being able to do these improvements is to ensure that there's enough spots to really accommodate in a well-designed way access to the building by anyone who's visiting and the people that are here full-time, which is our staff.
Mr. Chair. Randy?
You can see that the grounds have deteriorated over time as soon as you entered the building or before you even get into the parking lot. I'm curious if we've identified the cost of compliance with Title 21.
I'm not familiar with Title 21. If you could please let me know and we'd be able to follow up with information for you.
Are you talking about the new Title 21?
Yes, new Title 21 is the...
So that, yes, that would be... Okay, two points. On Title 21, the rendition here is complying with Title 21, which is primary landscaping, which is the new city code, or fairly new city code in that regard, and that is taken into account in the diagram for the updated parking lot and layout.
Right, but we have not identified the amount that is going to cost.
It's incorporated in that cost of what that additional landscaping would be.
Okay, and what triggered Title 21? Was it the expense of the remodel, of the demolition? What?
When you're doing to the chair, that actually has to do with the amount of money, and when you go to get city permits at a certain level, then it triggers Title 21 for any major improvements to buildings. But we do have a lot of green space on the property already, which will lessen the amount of Title 21, or I say lessen it, but we have all the trees along 27th Avenue, all that taken into consideration in the type of work that's being done, but we will need to add additional landscaping to the building under Title 21, but that is incorporated in this. And one thing to Commissioner Sandy's point, and that is we did have 11 spots up front on the one side that have been kept open for visitors. What we've done is we can now have 4 visitor spots in the front of the building, open the other 7 up for employees to try to bring more people from across the street. And with that, though, just when we have board meetings or when we have large meetings in the building, we just notify the staff that we need those 11 parking spots, and like we did today's meeting. And so it's just a couple times a month that we'll probably need those spots, but there are 7 of those spots are now open for employees. And they have been parking there, and that's why you see the adjustment of signs, the visitor signs.
Through the chair, board member Ellidge, if I could just follow up a little bit, again, with the specific information related to landscaping, and I apologize not being familiar with Title 21 specifically on that. We do have a budget that's in place, and it's defined within the numbers and also attached with the memorandum of $120,000 of that budget is related to landscaping. So when we showed the schematic on the future lot, it's the landscaping that is required by that title, by that code with the municipality, but having landscaping surrounding the entire property. So that's the additional landscaping that we're adding that would be with the demolition of the Blue Central, all along that additional parking lot area, which is new landscaping. We're also augmenting a bit of our current landscaping, and within that is a requirement on the number of trees that are involved on the property. So that's all-inclusive on that general number there.
For landscape.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Through the chair, the proposed law changes, it's hard to see on the screen, but on those it does identify where there is Title 21 requirements, which is usually pointing to new landscaping.
Yes. Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Curtis. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions?
Mm-hmm. I would just speak in favor of the improvements. I personally have experienced the confusion of getting here in the wintertime for a meeting years ago where you wind up going past the building and there's no access off Northern Lines. You can't. Yeah, if you miss it, you have to circle around through on 27th. But I would encourage you to continue your process, I mean, the building itself, and I think that the branding part of it is important, and there's no reason why a state agency can't have a nice facility. I think it's just a good idea, and somebody made a comment about the facility, so a little tired itself, and don't stop with these improvements. And don't forget to have lighting for your flags.
Okay, without further comments, I'll entertain a motion.
I move resolution number, this is Bill Kendrick, I move resolution number G22-08.
Bill Bibblemore, I second the motion. Further discussion?
This is Commissioner Sandy. I just wanted to thank Alan and Curtis and their teams for all of the, you know, thoughtful responses that we got in relation to this, and also just for continuing to have patience, and I'm looking forward to the improvements. Thank you.
Thanks, Julie. Amy, would you please poll the board?
Commissioner Sandy?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Kendig?
Yes.
Mr. Beaglemore?
Yes.
Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
Chair Cruz?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Okay, I'd like to, why don't we take a 10-minute break for personal reasons, and then we'll come back for director comments.
Chairing, you are on the record.
All right. Well, welcome back. We'll call the meeting back to order. We'll go back to the agenda. Next up on the agenda is item number 7, director's comments, starting with A, update.
Chair, board members, we want to give, and we've been scheduling this with each board meeting, giving an update on the current project, which is a focus on developing land for housing unit construction that would be available for military in support of their missions within Fairbanks North Star Borough, specifically partnership working with the city of North Pole. I'd like to ask if Angela Keese would join me. She has been our program manager, project manager really on this, and can give a current update of where things stand on some of the land reviews, if you would, please.
So we continue to progress the project with some design work. The boundary and topographic survey were completed, and we have a subdivision design. We're currently targeting a plat application with the Fairbanks North Star Borough for mid-August. We need to be working with the City of North Pole as we have obtained the results from the soil samples, which are favorable. So that should enable progressing an ordinance with the City of North Pole to proceed with purchasing the land.
And if I might take a bit of a step back just as a reminder for the board, so we have identified a piece of property within the City of North Pole, which in consort with the mayor of the City of North Pole as well as the City Council have focused particularly on that property. We did an initial environmental assessment, which came back very clean. However, out of an element of caution on our side, we wanted to ensure that there were some additional samples that were taken based upon the PFAS issues that are within the community broadly, within the Fairbanks North Star Borough community. And so that's what we've been following up on. Although I do not believe those samples have been fully analyzed at this point.
I apologize for not making you aware of that during the break. I did read an email from when I was on vacation. This is my day back. So we'll receive the formal report, but they were favorable as of yesterday.
Okay, so my apologies. So we do have that updated information that shows that it was a beneficial undertaking due to the additional sampling, which is in support ultimately of that particular property. So at this stage, what we've been advancing is those conversations with the City of North Pole about their acquisition of the property, and then under that structure, ultimately to transfer to ADA for our further development. Other issues related to that development that we're currently in conversations with is with the Fairbanks North Star Borough about a property tax exemption, which is a critical underlier for the economic feasibility of what we're proposing. Additionally, what we have presented to our delegation, Senator Murkowski and Senator Sullivan, is information supporting differences that currently exist within the Fairbanks Military Facility Zone and every other military facility area within the state of Alaska on the amounts of the housing allowance that are allocated by the military. So we presented that deficiency information to our delegation. They have presented that as well to the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense is currently in their information gathering point at this point. I think that's concluding at the end of June. And then there's going to be additional analysis of that in July. So we're hopeful that that information gets incorporated in the way they're looking at the allocations that will be defined for particularly the Fairbanks area. It is a critical economic feasibility element of this development. And as we learn more information of what the military is able to do in support of that area, we'll be able to analyze the financial profile of the investment, which is also part of our due diligence at this time. Morgan Neff, our Chief Investment Officer, really has been leading that side of it on the analysis. Morgan, if I could ask you if you would join us, if you could give an update to the board of where things stand just from the preliminary financial assessment.
I'm just curious on how many lots or units on the preliminary subdivision design?
We have a target of multiplexes that would qualify for the tax abatement and two apartment buildings for a total of 166. That's flexible given, you know, some final analysis, you know, it may go up or down, there may be some movement, but that is the concept that we're working with at the moment.
Regarding the financial analysis with this project, we've done an extensive review, and as you can quite imagine, the market has changed up and down on a variety of the inputs. Interest rates continue to move up, which, you know, has added additional costs, but we've also started to see supply side, you know, with lumber starting to compress, which has helped offset the interest rate move. So regarding what Executive Director Weiser was saying about the BAW, the base allowance for housing, it is very critical because if they are afforded the additional increase that we believe it deserves, this becomes very problematic from an economic perspective as a development. And so we continue to work with the delegation and the representatives there to help provide additional information as they go through another analysis, which is, you know, supposed to be going on right now, but also additional efforts as Executive Weichner has mentioned on the delegation side. I will tell you that the way that we have factored in the outline or the layout of the development is between 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms. And the way that the BAW is currently structured with and without dependents, it leaves a substantial portion of the military unavailable to rent based on current market conditions. And that is based off of not only what we're seeing as the current market conditions, but what applications have been processed to date for this type of development with the tax abatement within the military facility zone and what their anticipated rental revenue or rental stream is going to be. And I will tell you that it is not too different from what our analysis is going, it has produced, but it also has continued to support our analysis that there needs to be a myopic approach to adjusting those costs.
So ultimately, if the base housing allowances for the military within the Fairbanks military area is increased to at least the average across the state, what we see is that that's effectively a $200, $300 adjustment per month, which actually brings the development into a broad level of economic feasibility.
That's absolutely correct.
And a large driver on that, what we've seen actually, is the recent reduction in lumber prices. So a key benefit, and I just want to highlight this, what we've been identifying is on the level of 166 units within the city of North Pole area is a very large development. And if we're able to aggregate and pre-order supplies for the broad level of housing development for the contractors that would ultimately come in and be responsible for building out those units, those are the underlying benefits this larger development has within the environment that another developer may not be undertaking because they are looking at currently what's been applied for the property tax exemption within the borough is on the level of, you know, 4 pluses, 8 pluses, not at the level of 166 units that would be coming through, and those broad-based benefits to the underlying lease rates.
So now would that be coordination between developers or one developer?
It would be the former. We mentioned chair coordination amongst multiple developers. This is not intended for one single developer. It's coordinating pre-buying. If we're defining out the design and the layout, ultimately, as lots get identified for different housing builders to really commit to and build out, we can aggregate that up and pre-buy the supplies that are necessary for it on a larger inventory basis.
And then lastly, the way that we have constructed the financial model is really not factoring in some of the concessions that we're currently seeing right now. And in fact, we're being very conservative when it comes to the development of the actual underlying property. And we're taking the full estimate, which is, you know, a very 30,000-foot estimate, but also adding the 25% contingency value that we believe could cost the project in additional funds, and factoring in that into that analysis. And I'll say, hopefully what will happen with the ball, it still is able to pencil out from an economic feasibility standpoint under that scenario.
What's the rough magnitude overall, the total dollar amount?
You're looking at in aggregate between 50 to 65 million in total development costs, which includes the underlying property as well as the development costs of the vertical.
And what kind of feedback from the local financial institutions up there?
So far, the feedback has been very positive. They're looking to also support this as well. So we are in active conversations not only with the community up there, the financial community up there, but with all potential capital sources to help get this project move forward.
Okay. And Chair, that's the same with the building community. We've been reaching out to them, talking with them about what their interests are. It's really all coordinated with the parties that are in the market there. Everything that we're looking to undertake in the structure is to facilitate the existing home builders within that market, from the finance side, from ultimately undertaking some of the land development, the master planning on our side, and working with the Fairbanks North Star Borough and the City of North Pole in establishing up front what those benefits would be to those house builders. We've had, and I do want to identify, we've had a lot of support from our board member, Bill Fibblemore, who is representing the Fairbanks area. He's been directly involved in those conversations. And, again, we've been progressing it as much as we can with each of those different parties. What we currently have planned, and it's still going to take quite a bit of work, ultimately, for us to get there, is a presentation by August 3rd on the full dynamics of the proposed investment.
Thanks. I would just reiterate the importance of, you know, additional housing in the interior for this military expansion. There's been a lot of work that's gone into this. It's not an easy project. I guess, you know, certainly with the BAH being less than it is around the state, the 10-year tax abatement from the borough is certainly going to help a lot, but it hasn't produced the numbers that I think anybody really thought it was going to produce for new units. There's been several applications, but total units, Morgan, maybe 50 units?
I would say less than that. Yeah, less than total 50 units through the application phase, correct.
So I did have one question in the status of our agreement with City North Pole. I know that was going back and forth. Are we?
Yes, we need to engage. I think they were waiting on the results of the sampling before progressing, so we can do that now.
Excellent. I don't have anything else to add. Just this is very important to the economy in the interior for sure. Thanks.
And so ultimately, Chair, or what we're looking for is really housing units that benefit the military mission within the Fairbanks area, and really directly in support of really the expansion that we know has occurred in Isleston. That's been the key driver with it. It is what we're focusing on with the mission-related elements of ADA, why we're involved in this. So that's what we're looking to aggregate together to make a presentation by August 3rd on what those benefits are.
Alan, what is the feedback you're getting on from our federal representatives on getting that base that allowance increase for Fairbanks? What's the feedback, or what's the process, or how long does it take, or is it positive or neutral? What's the contingent on that?
So with the initial information that's being shared with the Department of Defense, there's two ways that they can ultimately address it. There is the ability to get an emergency allocation that would be effective on a short-term basis. Really, we're talking 1 year, maybe 2 years, but I think it's really fundamentally 1 year. 12 months being effective. And then during that time period, the concept is that with a emergency allocation or an increase, you then having a more in-depth review that would support then a permanent increase or the process, the formula being changed or addressed or information that ultimately comes in the way that that's addressed by their regulations in determining on a future basis what that housing allowance would be specifically for Fairbanks versus other areas. Through the work that Morgan and Angela have done that really identify the fact that you have, within the state, you have in the southeast, you have Anchorage, you have Fairbanks, we have Nome, Kodiak. There's different areas. There's the allocations of every place but Fairbanks are in the top 30 percentile within the level of housing allowances across the country. Fairbanks is below the 50% level. And within Alaska alone, it is definitionally over the last 2 years been at the bottom of the allocations on the housing allowances within the state, irrespective of what we know to be the cost of housing.
Fairbanks is more expensive than Anchorage.
That's correct. I mean, to your point, Chair, the third-party data that we used to review the support data to justify what we were showing as the appropriate increase continues to show for the last several years that Fairbanks remains in the top two or either single most expensive place to live within Alaska. So we don't quite understand what the disconnect is. All we can do is show what we're doing to provide justification for the increase, and I'll tell you, unless Angela has a better perspective, but I don't believe I've provided any kind of reasoning as to why the level in Fairbanks is materially different than any of the other five military housing areas within the state.
So from a waterfall standpoint, I guess, or decision-making process, what happens first? The base allowance is approved first before we start going down the path of spending the dollars to development? How is this going to work, Alan?
Chair, what we're looking to do in the way that we've addressed this with the delegation is that we have requested and identified the fact that we need to see that there is a adjustment that's been identified by the Department of Defense. And that could be through this emergency provision, in which case we're able to have a fundamental presentation on the economic feasibility to this board about the land development. But if it was an emergency declaration, it would be subject to some assumptions on the adjustments that would be following up. There is the ability for them to make a permanent or at least on the formula, the way that they announced the VA, the BOS annually, that would be by December through the regulatory process. So they're gathering data at this point in time. They have a review in July, and then there's an announcement ultimately what those housing allowances are at the end of the year. If we're required to wait at that point in time, the only time that we could present to this board the real underlying economic feasibility of the development is once we know what those base rates are. If we take the current base rates that have been historically, it does not broadly support the investment.
So, where's the Alaska Command on this? I remember listening to the general talking about, the Fairbanks needs housing. I would assume that Alaska Command knew what the housing allowance was and the deficiency Fairbanks had. So I'm really surprised, actually.
Well, through our review, we found out that this has been a perpetual issue that has been brought up, and I don't think it's been examined as well as what we've been able to provide on our analysis. And so I will say the command has been very supportive, very much engaged, and very much appreciative of us outlining the issues. But as far as, why it has continued to be and why the adjustments that really disconnected Fairbanks from the rest of the other MHAs, it's not justified. There's no data to support it, and with that, there's no narrative from the command to support it either. They just are appreciative, and they're doing what they can in order to help support the effort.
So we do have, and I really want to recognize, we do have support that's coming from our delegation. We meet weekly with them and update their staff where we're currently at. They are engaging with the Department of Defense. They're responding to us on areas of the discussion. We're sharing information, so we're really together trying to progress this particular issue. But again, to directly answer your question, Chair, we would have to be convinced as staff that there is a argument in place, a reasonable economic feasibility for the investment, and we are, I also would highlight, under our regulations, we're obligated to provide a financial plan that supports the underlying investment. There is a gap at this current point in our assumptions of what those future lease rates would be based on what the historical housing allowance has been specifically for Fairbanks. If this development was in Anchorage, as an example, this would not be the case. If this development was in Kodiak, this would not be the case.
Well, great update. Thank you.
Brings us to ADA fiscal year 2022 audit schedule. That's next.
So, Chair, Board members, well, we have attached, and also for the public, we have attached is a letter that we have received from the Department of Finance. It's a letter that we receive annually. And what we're trying to identify and benchmark for the board is the debt obligation that the state is looking for ADA's financial statements as a public corporation, ultimately to roll up into the state's broader financial statements that would be reported. So this is the day, October 17th is the requirement for the full financial statements. They are also identifying, the fact of having draft financial statements at an earlier point being October 3rd. So in our underlying arrangements with iBailey, we have identified September 30 as the target date for the completion of our financial statements. However, again, the obligation to the Department of Finance is October 17th. So we're working with within our shared service segment of ADA and AEA with our CFO, Donna Keppers, to ensure that we have a progress in place, timeline in place, that we are able to achieve this date of October 17th.
Is this timeline you're confident in, Alan?
I'm confident given the fact that we brought in iBailey as our new auditors last year. They've gone through the process with us. We were, as you're aware, Chair, we were late in reporting the final financial statements last year. I believe that was, again, based upon their first process through our books, understanding the different underlying projects and our programs. And they've already, I've seen the different crews from iBailey working with our staff at a very early point already on this. So I believe that we should be able to meet these requirements. But we will keep the board updated as we're progressing.
Alan, does ADA have a statutory deadline for providing the financial statements, or is this just a request from the state to meet their statutory deadline of producing a CAFR by December 15th, which they usually adhere to, other than the last few years?
ADA does not have a separate statutory obligation by any certain date to report its financial statements. We do, however, just to identify, we do have an obligation by January 10th to provide a copy of our financial statements to the legislature.
And I would imagine maybe ongoing disclosure potentially to the market. But I know I just asked because I know some other public corporations like the one I work with, we have an October 1st deadline, so this is a fairly leisurely schedule. But we don't always meet October 1st in the full disclosure.
To the Chair, thank you for identifying the fact that you don't always meet the timeline. It is dependent upon the current year situation.
Okay, that brings us to item number C, Alan.
So for the board, this is the monthly information that we're providing on our loan dashboard. The one thing that I have been identifying through the past meetings, and I really want to identify everyone in follow-up, is that there is, with our delinquency report, and delinquencies for this program, our loan programs, are extremely low. And I really want to highlight that that's really through the management that's coming with our commercial loan department, which is headed up by Tiffany Jansen, but also with the oversight coming from Morgan Neff, our chief investment officer.
What page are you looking at now?
I am looking specifically at page 13 of 13.
Right.
Which is the listing of our delinquency percentage. And what I'm looking to identify here is that the amount at 1.1% is really related to, and you'll see down below, loans that we currently have in through this program with KeyBank. And we've been identifying the issue that KeyBank does not have a loan servicing department for these Alaska loans in Alaska. They do services out of a general servicing group that's on the east coast of the U.S. So communication between and with Alaska borrowers and their service department is complicated. What we've seen is that has been leading to information that's not being shared on the amount of payments that are coming through, and if payments are being received, they're not being immediately transferred as well to ADA for our own loan books. So we're showing a very high level there of, identifying here 87%, 88% of the loans that we currently have with KeyBank are in a delinquent status, meaning not being paid on time. However, this is not particularly the issue of the borrowers. It is an issue with the loan servicer. So what we have done, just to identify with the board, is that under the terms of our agreement, we've identified to them that now this has gone on for over 90 days, that if we don't see improvement, that we're looking actually for KeyBank to purchase the full loans from ADA and remove them from our portfolio.
So when we talk about delinquency, we're talking just a few days beyond 30 days, but I don't know if that's in here, how far beyond terms?
In some cases, if there's allocations of payment that may be late that are coming from the borrower, say that the borrower may be over 30 days that's made the payment, but we're also seeing what gets added into our delinquency level is when that payment is received by the service department within KeyBank on the East Coast, they may not be automatically allocating that to our payment, so we're registering in some cases payments that are over 60 days.
Are you talking with the senior staff here in Alaska?
We have addressed it with the loan representative. There is, again, this has all been relegated to their service department, and those individuals are not in Alaska.
But you haven't talked to Key President of KeyBank Alaska?
We have not, because they're not the key party that has been designated by KeyBank to be identified with these loans. We have gone directly to the service parties and the loan officer that's been identified through our agreements with the service bank, and ultimately to register the letter in this case. Chair, I believe I understand what you're asking. That ultimately that has not been helpful in the conversations. But I'm trying to identify, but to put it very bluntly, we've been redirected to talk to the people at the service department. So again, we have addressed a letter to KeyBank on these particular loans, and at this point in time, we're hopeful that the process will change. That's really the material part of what I want to identify with the loan participation, the loan report. And then for the board, we have under D, we have the development project financing report, which is really the identifying the principal projects we've undertaken. These are what we've also referenced as our fact sheets related to the projects that we have directly. If there's been a change that's under the specific project, we will identify that ultimately the date that's on the fact sheet itself and really ask the board if there's any specific questions that we can address about the different projects and the project fact sheets. So Not hearing any questions. Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, I found these fact sheets really informative. This is a great addition. I hadn't seen this before in this format, but I'm very appreciative of that. Thank you to you and your staff.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Board Member Ellidge. It's really changes that we've implemented over the last few months, taking from this was presented in various different forms, one through a spreadsheet and some through different project fact sheets. So we really try to consolidate the information.
Good job.
So the next item under Director Comments is 7E, Pre-Development Projects Quarterly Report. This is a follow-up on the report that was asked quite a while ago by the board as far as the underlying pre-development activity that we have, which is principally the Amber Access Project and the West of Sedna Access Project. And so different resolutions have been approved by the board and the amount of spending that's been registered under those developments, so you're aware. Within the West of Sedna Access, again, we had identified several levels of funding. There was an initial phase one of $50,000 allocated by the board in partnership with other parties for preliminary fieldwork activities on that the project development. Then with G2020, we had an additional $162,000, and then ultimately with G2128, we had the allocation from the legislature of $8.5 million to support the permitting an application to the Corps for a 404 permit on the road route that was identified. So ultimately with this, we recognize that we have spent at this point in time $1.4 million under that total amount of funding in pursuit of the permitting and pre-development work on the West of Sedna Access Road. And additionally, with the various allocations that were given for the Ambler Access Project, we have allocated additional funding now in total amounts of budgetary pre-development final feasibility work in partnership with Ambler Metals and in working with permitting access provided by Doyon for the private land portion, NANA with their private land portion, the state, and then also the federal government under the programmatic agreement and the joint record decision. We have allocated in excess at this point in time of $48 million of our total of $70 million that was identified partnership with Ambler Metals for the, you know, the $35 million from coming from ADA, of the $35 million from them. So in total, there was a total of $48 million. Our allocation under this is $19.4
million. Alan, are you seeing any, are you feeling the repercussions of inflation or on your pre-development work?
So with the pre-development work, it's mostly related to field studies, still final feasibility, it's design work, it's professional services that are in large part there. As you are aware with the presentations on the budget, a large component is logistics. So with logistics, it becomes fuel for helicopters, fuel for ultimately making sure that there's access and transport of the different crews, broadly food as well. So yes, there has been inflationary impact that is within our initial budgeting, but it has not caused us to make an adjustment that we need to come to the board at this point in time. My anticipation, however, in saying that is that as we get closer to a full design on the road, that will, with current costs and future expectations of iron costs for the bridge work, culverts, again, transport issues related to the full construction, there will likely be adjustments in some of the preliminary discussions we talked on the total capital cost for the road development. So then for the board, we as well have the quarterly investment measuring, on our internal investments that's available for the board.
How are we doing?
If there's any information,
Are we insulated
from the stock market?
I would have Morgan have
Captain Morgan there taking care of there.
A chief investment officer, one of the roles and responsibilities is the engagement with Talon, our external advisor on this, as well as the engagement with the underlying external money managers. In this case, Morgan, I would ask you, would you please give just a brief assessment of where we are?
Yeah, brief. We're obviously not completely insulated from what is going on in the interest rate market, but we have now seen the losses in the equity market far accelerate than those of within the investment grade market, which is where our primary allocation is. As a reminder, Talon will be here on August 3rd to present to the board in person, and I encourage you to have any questions and concerns, and then we're also working through the search, as we discussed last time, and so he'll be able to give you an update on that if that's what you desire. But I'm pleased with the performance in this market. I can spend all day talking to you about my macro concerns, but I won't. But I'm pleased that the board decided to not divert course and take on more risk at that time, and continue to deploy the risk within Alaska and its communities. So thank you.
Thank you, Warren. Don, could you remind us again, because I get a little confused with this mark-to-market and whether or not how we do our financials now. Our fiscal year ends here in next month?
Our fiscal year ends with the state. That's on June 30th of each year.
So will there be a do we have to take a hit or a neutral, or where are we at when it comes to the investments as far as our financial performance?
So we recognize within our income statements realized and unrealized gains.
Okay.
So what if there is a long position and there's been adjustment, a capital adjustment in the value of that, that is recognized in the income statement as an unrealized gain. If we actually sell the security for a loss or a profit, then that is a realized gain. So broadly what we're talking about, the impact of going on a portfolio and the adjustments that our external money managers do, is to the extent largely unrealized gains or losses. And what I would identify what Morgan was stating is, with the board over the last 9 months specifically, we've been having discussions about our investment policy. Our position and what was agreed with the board is maintaining an investment policy that in large part I would define as being conservative. We're looking to manage our capital to be available for the projects we're looking to undertake and invest within the state of Alaska. We have not, and we do not take our mission or our statutes to be principally money managers for gains of external investments outside of Alaska. These are capital that in large part, Chair, as you and I have discussed, we've discussed broadly with the board, it's been identified for specific projects and available for future projects that are needed within the state of Alaska. So in order to do that, we define an investment portfolio that largely requires an investment grade rating and a yield, which means that we're looking at really long-term securities from U.S. Treasuries, investment grade level corporate bonds. That is the material part of our portfolio. When interest rates increase, as they have broadly, and as presented by Callan,
in May.
There have been effects, ultimately there's been an impact to our portfolio, but much less than if we had been invested into equities or higher risk securities that have been much larger impacted by the inflationary pressures occurring right now.
Yeah, and just one last thought is that, over those last 9 months, I try to convey that we had present valued a substantial amount of our future return in this portfolio because of the interest rate market. Ideally, a fixed income portfolio with this high of quality is not supposed to generate 8% annual rate of returns in a 0% rate environment. But because of the flight to quality and the compression of rates, we pulled forward a lot of that return. And subsequently, I added that we will be getting some of that back in the form of unrealized gains, but if we're investing on a 3% yield to maturity market, as long as we avoid the credit risk and the credit defaults, we will get a 3% yield, and I'm just using an arbitrary number. So we pulled forward a lot of the return. We're giving some back just because of the unrealized side. But overall, the return picture, as we invested in it, has not changed over a long-term basis.
I just remember that something changed. We got the legislature approved something, and we got these, you know, everybody's working really hard, and the P&L statement, but there's these big swings based on the market, and that, you know, obviously it was a challenge to keep up with, and I just want to, for the board's sake, that was changed 2 years ago?
That was changed, I believe, in 2018, with the dividend statute, in order to recognize the fact that these types of swings do not come into or impact the dividend, because we're really trying to look at it on a cash basis of the amount that's being produced within our specific funds, and that's our revolving fund, the CESS fund, and the Arctic Infrastructure Development Fund. Now, why all these funds are important, because that's where our principal project investments come through. And with the Arctic Infrastructure Development Fund, it is the investments that we're talking about with the Anwar Access Project. So once that project reaches fruition and has returns, there are going to be broad benefits that are coming from our dividend distribution through that fund. But the impacts right now of unrealized gains or losses, which is, again, not cash directly received by the organization, that is excluded from our measurement of the level of dividends that are being paid. So there's benefits in years where we have large losses or unrealized losses from interest rate changes that occur within that we're unable to control. And it also excludes in cases where we haven't realized a gain, as Morgan has highlighted.
All right, thank you.
So then for the board, the final comment really coming from myself on 7G is the fact that we have the next scheduled board meeting being August 3rd. Wednesday, August 3rd.
All right, that gets us to number 7, and now we're going to item number 8. So the executive session, ongoing litigation related to the Anwar Access Project, protected by attorney-client privilege. So I will entertain a motion to go to executive session.
This is Board Member Kendi. I move that the board enter an executive session to discuss ongoing litigation, which is attorney-client privilege, information, and confidential. This is supported by the Open Meetings Act, which allows the board to consider attorney-client privilege, information, and confidential matters in executive session. The discussion of these subjects would have an adverse effect upon the finances of ADA and or are protected by law.
Bill Vivelmar, second motion. Is there any objection going to the executive session? Hearing seeing none, we will move into executive session. Can you hear us, Julie?
Yep, I can hear you.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, I'll advise the board to not take any actions on matters discussed while in executive session other than discuss ongoing litigation with counsel. Brings us back for agenda. Next up is item number 9, board comments. Julie?
Thanks. This is Commissioner Sandy. I just wanted to comment to the board and the staff how much I appreciate today's discussions. And then also, I didn't comment during the comment portion with relation to the Fairbanks project, but I just wanted to thank the staff in particular about our North Pole, because that project to me is the perfect example of the ways in which ADA can be working on behalf of the state in a more nimble fashion than other state agencies could. And I think that, you know, we discussed at length, you know, the public good related to that project. And, you know, we're all very well aware of the housing challenges that communities are having. So I just wanted to call that project out and thank the staff for all of the ways in which they are really sticking with the project and trying to really help the state and help Alaskans out. I think it's a great example. Thank you.
Thanks, Julie. Bill?
Nothing yet. Thanks.
Randy?
I don't have anything to add at this time. Thank you, Chair.
good meeting, and I want to thank staff for all the detail in their reports. It's appreciated and very helpful.
Kevin?
We're doing closing thoughts.
This is comments. What are comments?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Well, I really like that shirt.
Uh-oh.
That's it. Thank you. Well.
Well, maybe I'm too casual. I'd like to thank the board for being with us today and all good stuff. Obviously, Alan and staff appreciate all the information. As we know, I was in Fairbanks yesterday, and it was nice and smoky. I report there's 141 fires out there, 15 are manned. Doesn't look very good for the next week, at least for Alaska, and any rain release. If I understand about Alan, weather-wise, you couldn't get to where you wanted to go to yesterday?
So, Board Chair, we were up in Kotzebue with the invitation of NANA, with the Subsistence Advisory Committee related to the Amber Access Project. So we had 2 days that were in Kotzebue. One of the days was going to be a tour with the Subsistence Advisory Committee on the Red Dog Mine and the road and port operations as a good example of what we're talking about with the Amber Access Project development. So they are able to see those facilities, but then also get the input from NANA on how Subsistence has been really managed with that road as well. So unfortunately, we did not get the opportunity to fly out to the mine at the invitation of SEC as well on that, but we did have a day in to really focus on workforce development issues around the project.
Thank you, Alan. And I'd like to thank Rainey and the rest of the staff for help today. Nice lunches. And look forward to our next, I guess the 3rd of August meeting. With that, we'll go to item number 10, work session, board training on roles and responsibilities. And we have a Department of Law instructor with us today. She would introduce herself for the record.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Wendy Horton. I am an attorney with the Department of Law. Thank you guys for allowing me a few minutes today, just briefly, to hopefully encourage you as you continue your service on this board, and then also to maybe give you a couple of nuggets of information that you can take with you that maybe will help you during your service, and maybe a final hope that some of the things we talk about today will open the floor for some new questions and some additional training going forward. What we're going to do today is really brief and a high-level overview of board membership and some of the, I think, key components that come along with that. Like I said, high level, we're just scratching the surface. There are a lot of nuances to different laws and different regulations that are going to apply to board members that are in this type of service that you're in. So I think going forward, it would be up to you guys and working with Alan to maybe request additional training if there's any particular areas of interest, like if you have particular ethics questions or if we want to dig into Open Meetings Act in more particularity or anything like that. So keeping that in mind, if you have any particular questions as we go through, please just stop me or interrupt me. There's no problem there. I will try to get you guys out of here as quickly as possible so you can enjoy the rest of your Wednesday afternoon. So first, just saying thank you for your service. The position that you serve here is really important to the state of Alaska, for the people of Alaska, and also economic development throughout the state. So the decisions that you make on this board are very important to the state. So thank you for that. It also sets the stage for the importance and the due diligence that you put in as a board member. In learning how to govern different bodies or different institutions, and AIDA is no different than that. Generally, the way that I approach practicing law and talking to my clients is looking at it from some sort of a goal-oriented approach. What are our common goals, or what is it that we are actually trying to accomplish, our end goal, so that we can work our way backwards from there sometimes. So, some of the goals that are
the key goals that I look at when you're talking about board governing or serving as a board member are looking at the actual governing of the organization, but also the internal teamwork that goes on in serving on a board. So I really look at that as kind of a two-pronged approach, is looking at the legal or the more practical structure that you've got to go through from that governing standpoint, but then also looking at the internal inner workings of the whole team that makes up the board. So, you know, obviously chair and board members, but also your executive level staff members that you're going to be communicating with and working with, especially at board meetings, and then being able to, you know, review reports, financial information, and things like that. So we want to make sure that that teamwork and that cohesiveness stays in place even while the board is trying to do that higher level governing. There is some information that I've provided for especially new board members just based on the general nature of ADA, statutory basis, and some of the differences, the nuances that ADA has as compared to some of the other state corporations that that Alaska has. One of the key things that I want you guys to remember serving on ADA's board is that, you know, ADA is exempt from the Administrative Procedures Act in many, many situations. However, as we know, we are subject to Open Meeting Act, so we need to make sure that we are always cognizant of that. And we'll touch on this just a little bit, you know, briefly later, but, and that is one of the key responsibilities of anyone who's serving in a chair position, is making sure that on a procedural basis that meetings are following through with any of those requirements that the corporation has got to meet. Another key component of serving in board membership is, you know, remembering, and this is from an administrative practical side, but also from the legal side of making sure that you're aware of potential liabilities that could arise, is that your main goal as a member of the board is to advance ADA's mission or ADA's statutory purpose. It's not for any, you know, personal investment purposes. It's not for any personal advancement. It is strictly for furthering ADA's mission or ADA's purpose. You know, what we're looking at here is, you know, we talk about this at every board meeting. I'm sure that, you know, you guys talk about it considerably more than what it even comes up at board meetings. But, you know, what ADA is tasked with is looking at promoting Alaska industry, looking at undertaking projects and programs that are going to aid in employment opportunities for the people of the state of Alaska. And so that is something that, as a board member, it needs to stay in the back of your head as you make decisions and as you consider different possibilities and different investments that ADA, you know, has on its plate. That being said, I do think it is important to stress with some of these government corporations that are pseudo-public, pseudo-private, pseudo-nonprofit, just kind of a mix, a conglomerate of a lot of different entity structures kind of squished into one. So we want to make sure that we are keeping not only in line with that mission and purpose, but that we're making sure that we've got some very clear policies in place and that the board is really taking that high-level approach to not the micromanagement side of the day-to-day operations or staff operations of the entity or the corporation, but making sure the macro management is happening. And a lot of that really can happen and can take part from a policy standpoint if you really are practical in making sure that as a board you set very clear policies and procedures in how you want to operate your board meetings. And from what I've observed in my short time here, you guys do a good job of following the procedures that have been set in place. And then trying to keep each other in check of making sure that those policies are also maintained. I do think it's important to note from a board perspective, for due diligence purposes, it is important that any policies and procedures that you set in place, that you do review those on, and it doesn't necessarily have to be an annual basis if that policy or procedure is serving the entity well, but at least on a periodic basis.
that you reviewed policies and procedures to see if there is a necessity for some sort of a change, just based on maybe internal operations of the entity. It might be a change of staff or a change of different executive roles. That'll give you the opportunity to take a look to see if those policies and procedures are still serving the whole organization well, not just the board, not just the executive staff, but the overall agency as a whole. A few things that I just wanted to highlight, just as reminders, I feel like most of you guys are pretty seasoned as far as service to different entities or service on boards. So I feel like some of this may be just reminders and not, you know, brand new eye-opening type of information for you. But one thing to remember in a very strict legal sense is serving on as a member of a board doesn't give any one member any heightened authority over any other member. Wearing a title doesn't mean that, you know, a chair is necessarily going to have more weight than any other member. That just means that Dana has to manage you guys and keep you in check at the meetings. Yes, yourself too. But I think that's important to remember internally and externally as well, is that no individual board member is the representative of ADA. It is everyone as a whole. So collectively, the board acts. That's something that also can kind of tie back to teamwork and how you guys work together as a team. Just in board trainings and things that I've done in the past, just a few kind of the ideas or kind of tidbits of examples that I've had would be, you know, in a team environment, you want to be the team player, so participating and making sure you're actively participating, obviously, you know, being present if you can be or being able to call in is, you know, one of the keys, but preparing for meetings adequately and voicing your opinion, doing so obviously respectfully, but making sure that you do put your opinion on the record and that you are actively participating. One of the things that does, obviously, is going to help with the teamwork. It also is going to help create a really consistent legal record if there is an issue that comes up later on as far as board meetings or board governance goes. If there is active participation by all parties, we've got a clear argument that everyone is taking care of their due diligence, is actively participating, and that the board is appropriately managing the entity as their task. So that really just helps create the record of the appropriateness of time and efforts that the board members are putting in to the governing of the entity. And as I think all of us know, if you're part of a team, everybody feels a little bit better if all team members are actively participating or putting in effort. So I have a few just kind of, you know, common sense, more or less, just tips that I wanted to run through, just kind of thoughts for going forward as you guys interact with each other and as you interact with the executive officer level here at ADA and staff. So just as far as team building goes, just some tips. Listen to fellow board members. Each member has to know where another person is coming from and be able to fit all the goals together. You don't necessarily have to agree, but you do want to come to some sort of a consensus. Just one other tip on being a good team player: when votes are, you know, called up for the board, I would recommend that you would attempt to not abstain from voting, so actively participate in votes at any point that you can, provided that you don't have a conflict of interest, so that you are actively participating. And again, so that the entity is creating a good record, a good voting record of what our decisions are internally and how those decisions have come about, why those decisions have been made. Let's see, following up or continuing along with being a good board member, tell fellow board members openly when you agree with them or when you disagree. If a member is vocal only when you disagree, it appears just to be grumpy, naysayer, yes. So if you would voice your approval at things as well, that goes a long way with other board members, executive officers, and staff. Don't let disagreements on one issue carry over to the next.
on the agenda, one agreement or disagreement should stand on the merits alone on that issue. Once that's over with, the vote is calculated, move on from there. Except the fact that there will be split votes on the board from time to time, no matter how hard you work for consensus, there will be issues that are decided with a majority and sometimes a minority. If you're on the minority side and you've advocated well for your side, then you should accept the majority decision and you should support the board's decision internally and externally to the public. If you're on the majority side of the issue, don't be a punk. Give due respect to the minority issues and do not be a rude, gloating winner. Leave disagreements at the board table or in the board room. When the meeting is over, the debating is over also. After the meeting, it's time to rebuild team spirit to the best of your ability. There is no such thing as knowing all one needs to know about the complex job that is governing ADA. It is a learning process for everybody. Every day is a new day, and there's new challenges that are faced every day. We all are going to come and do the best that we can and make sure that we've done our due diligence prior to our meetings and prior to undertaking any votes.
So I have a question on that. So when if a subject matter is before us in a vote and there is a disagreement, typically what people do is they take the information, pick or choose whatever they say like to portray whatever part of the decision they're on, yes or no. Sometimes that's taking information that the organization provides, right? I mean, as a board member, you're going to get the information from the organization, whether you're for or against it. That somehow could bring in the folks that provided the information, maybe in a negative way. How would we make sure that doesn't happen?
I think this is a key communication issue. And one of the key parts of being an effective board is how you communicate with the entity and the organization itself. In chain of command, the flow of communication, that's a communication structure or communication system itself that needs to be set and established by board direction, but also just completely hand-in-hand with the way that the entity operates. So, you know, one thing for, I think, everyone to remember when we're operating in a business setting is it is easy to let our emotions come into play, especially when we are super close to an issue or we have worked particularly hard on a particular matter. I can speak for myself when I say if I've been, you know, elbows deep in a case and I have spent a tremendous amount of time on it and lost sleep over it and it's something that I feel very strongly about, I can let my personal emotions get mixed into that and it can drive me in a direction that is not the best course of action for the overall business. So I do think it is important for board members, for staff, for everybody involved when we're in a business setting to try to take that step back and take a breath and remember business, it can feel personal, it's not personal. The overall goal and the overall mission of the board, and I think in this situation it is of executive officers and staff as well, but the overall goal of everyone here is moving ADA forward and having some successful economic development for Alaska. So we all have the same end goals in mind. We just need to make sure that we're communicating those effectively. I do think chain of command really does help with that, though, is if we establish good communication processes of if there is potentially negative news, how we want to deliver that, maybe who that needs to be directed to. So these are the internal conversations that as a board, you guys as the members need to have with the executive director of the organization is how do we best communicate some of these ideas or some of these challenges that we're going through. But I think ideally at the end of the day, everybody, no matter the position, has got to remember there is an end goal, and it's not personal to anybody, regardless of what your position is. Okay. I do have some tips now, though, on how not to be a good
board member. If you want to hear some of those. So, if you talk too much and listen too little, see, I'm trying to speed up and not talk too much. If you ask as if you have answers for all the issues, if you refuse to change your mind on any issues, no matter what the evidence is presented to you. This is one area I would say as a board member, to be mindful of staff reports especially. There are times that we can come in, I think it's in a role where it's perceived that we have more power, that we're in this decision-making role, that we have already got this preconceived notion of, I've looked at this report, I already have an idea of how I feel about this or how I would vote on something. And regardless of additional information or new information that's brought to light, you still just want to drive your point home and not have an open mind to that information is a really good way to, I think, get anyone, not just, you know, in a business setting or a board setting, but to get people to shut down and not want to actively engage in a good collaborative conversation anymore. So I think just being open-minded, especially when presented with new information, is really important. Let's see. If you refuse to compromise, no one's going to like you. Ignore advice from fellow board members. So what I have perceived thus far is everyone that I have had the opportunity to witness this with has done a very good job of listening to other board members and really having, I would say, open mind to the conversations and constructive criticism that comes from other board members. So, you know, just remembering that we all do come from different perspectives and different backgrounds, and we all have different strengths and weaknesses. And so to remember that regardless of, you know, personally how you might feel about somebody, that person is going to have some strengths that you don't have and can bring something to the table if you'll just open your eyes to that. If you leak information from a closed board session, I'm going to get really mad at you, but your fellow board members are not going to like you either. And obviously that's going to raise some liability issues for Ada. So don't do that. No pointing at the table. Don't publicly criticize board decisions. Obviously I think this is common sense and goes without saying, but sometimes we can let our mouths run away with us. But don't criticize the work of Ada or staff or the economic development efforts that Ada is undertaking, even if it's a particular investment that you may not personally agree with. If the board has decided that that's in the best interest of Ada and moving Ada forward, then that is the front that you are going to want to put forth as well in the public eye, or just be quiet. You know, the age old, if you can't say anything nice, just don't say anything at all. That would still fit here. Okay, real quick, I just want to run through a couple of different, like, professional, you know, roles, responsibilities, and then also just kind of a little bit of a breakdown of obviously the roles. Like, we've got board members, and we talked just briefly earlier, Dane is the chair. It doesn't mean he's the king. He still gets one vote just like everybody else does. But I also think it's important for, and this is where that chain of command and communication system really makes a big difference, is we've got multiple members of a board and we have multiple staff members that are all doing their best to move Ada forward. If every board member communicates with every staff member with different requests or different questions about different reports at different times, and there is no cohesive way to communicate, that can really cause a completely chaotic organization to where there cannot be effective communication internally with the staff from the executive director because there's so many misdirections. And so really there needs to be a cohesive plan of communication in place so that the board knows the channels to follow. And if it's, you know, on particular issues, generally speaking, the way that this is going to work is the board is going to be that hierarchy governing body, and your executive director is your day-to-day CEO who's going to handle your hiring, your firing, your putting out fires, I mean, everything that would come up you know, in the day-to-day operations of the business, that is the person that you want to defer to on how communication flows inside of that organization, because your executive director is going to be the key person to let you know, what it's like inside the organization, who communicates best with whom, how are problems communicated best, how are wins communicated best. There are different channels that we want to take and different methods of communicating depending on if we've got good news, if we've got bad news, if we've, you know, got no news. So there are a lot of different ways that we can handle this. But this is an area that I do think would be really beneficial for the board to spend a little bit of time just chit-chatting about and discussing with Alan and the executive team on clear communication channels and methods. And I mean that in, you know, who you're going to talk to, how you're going to communicate with them. Is it going to be by phone? Is it going to be by email? Is it going to be by Teams? You know, is it going to be during certain meeting times that are pre-scheduled? All of this, you know, obviously it can be flexible. You don't always have to stick within those parameters if there's a need to change it. But all of those parameters and that type of system is really going to, it's going to free you guys up a little bit more as board members, because it's not so helter-skelter. You know, it will be more organized, and you can have a set plan for submitting comments or submitting complaints and then having those dealt with appropriately. But I do think that would be very beneficial for this board, especially to just have some conversations about just putting some clear communication systems in place, just to make sure no one's overwhelmed at any particular point, and also to make sure that the board's messages can clearly be communicated to the right people and then disseminated from there as appropriate.
And then there's a dissemination that the individuals, like you could assign a board member to some project, and you would assign any staff to some project.
And then, well, you know, there's committees and things where there's still going to be some inner workings that are a little bit different than that normal flow. But yes, you're right. I mean, normally it would flow from board members to board chair to executive director. And here, in a lot of organizations, you know, there's some differences that come from that, which is just based on operations of each organization, which completely makes sense. Like in Ada's case, it would make sense that there's going to be some direct communication with the chief investment officer. So our high-level officer positions, it completely makes sense that those individuals who have that level of expertise would be providing the reports that are within their expertise areas. And that questions, you know, could go back and forth to those individuals as well. So that's not problematic in and of itself. If when you have each individual board member or multiple board members reaching out to multiple staff members or multiple executive level officers so that work or attention is so bifurcated at that point of who am I answering to, and not only who am I answering to, where do my priorities lie at this point? What do I put at the top of my list? Who do I answer to first? So you can see it really can create, you know, kind of some headbanging there as far as we don't know who's going to take priority or precedent over the others. So we just want to make sure that that's clear in everybody's head. But that definitely goes a long way with executive officers for sure, so that they're not kind of pulled in all different directions, but so that staff has a really clear line of communication as far as the organization of the entity and the structure of who they need to talk to if there is an issue. You know, we also want to make sure that you guys as board members are fulfilling your role of a hands-off manager. You know, you guys are not supposed to be in the day-to-day. I don't want to see emails from you guys personally back and forth to staff members about them complaining about job situations, okay? You as a board member should not be in a position where, you know, you are communicating individually about these inner workings. You're getting too in the weeds and potentially opening the board up for liability if you're not aware of all of the situations that you're kind of getting involved in. So I think it's important on, you know, multiple fronts that we have those communication systems clearly in place for everyone.
Just quickly to follow up on Devin, what you had highlighted, I think broadly, that is the way communication has been. It has broken down in some circumstances. It's worth reinforcing, you know, about the issue of how we're able to organize that information, pass it along to staff, make sure that that is coming back in our understanding of what you're looking for, that there's not any confusing direction that's happening where there's duplication of work, unnecessary duplication that would be occurring.
Yeah. Perfect. And I think, you know, Alan, that speaks to, you know, staff frustrations at any organization. If you don't know who you're answering to and you don't know what you're supposed to be providing, that's going to be a pretty frustrating job for anyone. So we want to make sure that, you know, as board members, your governing or your governance of the organization should optimize the organization's function. You know, overall, I mean, push them towards the mission, but that high-arching governing that you're doing as a board member takes you out of the day-to-day and lets you provide that high-level oversight that Alan might not be able to get up to look at because he is dealing with all of the day-to-day oversight. So you guys are really the sounding board and also the help on the external side. So if ADEX finds itself, you know, up against a wall with certain organizations, that the board can step in and say, hey, wait, I have relationships with those people, or hey, we can brainstorm on how to get around this roadblock. So really that higher level managing and not getting into any of that day-to-day operation. And that really, it does help with the internal organization of the entity and being able to just operate seamlessly and smoothly without too many cooks in the kitchen trying to drive things. So one of the things I think, Alan, your role as executive director here is really, like, pretty well established. I don't think that we've had, you know, a whole lot of breakdown or anything like that. I just, you know, I want to make it clear that when we're dealing with an executive director, you know, it's a nuanced relationship. It is an employee relationship in some regards between the board and the executive director. However, it has to be a full team player, a team role. Like, that Alan has to be, you know, a seat at the table of the decisions, not just providing the information, but because he is driving the entity and understands the day-to-day, he's going to have additional information that is very pertinent to the conversations and the decisions of votes that you guys are making that might not always show up on paper in the report. So it is really important that that is an open relationship and there is an open mind that's kept, you know, between that relationship. So the board's relation to staff is something that we've talked about a few different times, and I want to reiterate that although technically the board approves budget, approves staffing, approves hiring, that is something that you guys do want to be hands-off on. Because in practice, the board really has one employee that is answering to the board and that the board is checking on, and that is the executive director role. And so I think if you keep that in mind, that can help drive your communication with other staff members and how you communicate with them, the way that you ask questions, and hopefully the way that your comments or questions might be perceived, is that you'll just keep that in mind, is that the executive director is really the only employee that is answering to the board directly, and that the board is going to directly govern. And then it is up to the executive director then to appropriately manage the rest of the staff from there. And I don't know, for me, when I started on boards, that takes a little bit of the pressure off, that you think, like, oh, wait, I'm not supposed to be managing everything. Like, that one's not my problem. That one's not my problem. Like, I'm only supposed to be focused on certain particular issues, those higher-level issues. Let's see. this for you.
I'm just kidding. This is for board chairs in general. So for whoever else that might want to sit in that chair at any point going forward, I just a couple of just real brief words that I use to describe the chair, or ideal words of where you would be moving this position along, would be a planner. So helping plan meetings, helping plan and approve agenda. A facilitator. Facilitating conversations, if you find that somebody's not actively participating, helping facilitate that moving forward. A delegator, delegating authority based on people's strengths, you know, appointing committee members or asking people to serve on committees. Helping with delegation at the executive director level, if the executive director needs an assistant delegating certain work or reports to different internal internal departments or different internal persons, then that can all be done. A liaison, and I think of this as internal and external. Internal, between the board and the executive director, back and forth, but also external, as far as external affairs, community affairs go. And then also a team builder, looking to make sure that relationships are staying intact. If you do notice that there's any type of strife or anything like that going on, bringing that to the attention of the board or bringing that to the attention of the executive director so that it can be taken care of. Because remember, at the end of the day, we've all got the same goals in mind, and that's advancing AIDA's purpose and moving that forward. So as long as we go back to that, I think we keep that in the back of our heads, then we'll be able to all work together nicely and fulfill our roles. And then one last thing, of course, obviously as a lawyer, I have to come and talk to you about the law stuff and not just the higher level, like feel good, be a board member, thank you for your service. But, you know, a couple of things to remember is it's very limited in Alaska, especially, so that's a good thing for board members. There is limited personal liability for serving on boards if you're in a fiduciary capacity. So AIDA has investments that kick all of you guys into a fiduciary role on the board. And it's a good thing and a bad thing. It's not, yeah. Yes, and there's Alaska has really great laws for being able to step in and indemnify board members and things like that too. So really robust protection. So I only say that just to, like, kind of scare you, not really, just to make you listen to the next things that I have to say, and that you have a duty of loyalty and a duty of care. I'm here for the last guy. No, but you have a duty of loyalty and a duty of care to the organization that you're serving. And it's not just the organization. If you remember the whole purpose, stated mission of AIDA, it's the state of Alaska. It's the residents here. It's the people of the state of Alaska who are set to benefit from AIDA's economic development. And so that's where your loyalty lies. The duty of loyalty deals with not having conflicts of interest. Like, don't usurp deals that AIDA is supposed to have and take them for yourself. Things like that. But then, your duty of due care has to do with, you know, taking care of your due diligence. Be reasonably informed. Review material that's sent to you. Whether it comes from staff or is directly related to a board meeting, you know, these reports are really important. And you need to make sure that you're taking a look at that as far as your due diligence goes. Otherwise, I mean, that can, you know, move you into the realm of negligence if you are not actively performing your job as a member of the board. If you don't think you can perform that job, then you need to resign and let somebody else fulfill that job. But you do need to make sure that you're able to fulfill those duties of care and duty of loyalty to the organization and to the underlying constituents that it serves. Told you guys that would be brief. Again, I would like the opportunity to discuss with you guys in further detail later on about additional trainings that dig into specifics like Open Meetings Act or ethics, or some, you know, additional professional communication type training. I think that would be beneficial as well. But otherwise,
you guys have any questions, I'm happy to answer. And
Mr. Chairman. Wendy, thank you for this. You know, it would have been timely for me to have this information when I first became a board member, and I would suggest that, Alan, that you consider including that in packages for board members going forward. I would also suggest that this would be appropriate information for any board member in the state.
Well,
good information. Thank you.
Different times. I mean, but I, if you guys are interested in us creating, you know, just a real easy to use form that you guys could use again, then that would be, that'd be fine.
I would ask, and I think Randy, you raised a very valid point that we should be preparing ourselves, you know, an information packet for our board members, and if it's you, you know, can be utilized on a broader basis, great. We've been really looking at or relying upon that broader information before your board members or defined as board members or with that, you know, acceptance in aligning it. But I think we really should be undertaking on our side this base of information. I know some other private corporations do undertake it that way, public corporations of the state do take it that way, and we'll definitely implement that. Thank you.
You mentioned further work sessions, and I would hope we could have something about dealing with the public and dealing with the press in particular. And then the other thing is, when I first came on the board, there was a new administration, and it was pretty a big change, pretty hectic things going on. And I probably got board policies for ADA and AEA, but I'd like to get another one. Again, so I can familiarize myself with that.
Wendy, thank you. I think it's great. I think the next one we should, you know, maybe in a quarter or so, do something on open meetings, and maybe put together a list of ones we can do once a quarter or every 6 months to keep. I will call it continuing education. And I think this is about the right amount of time, to, you know, for the board to take it on. You know, it's about an hour. Anything longer than that after a board meeting, you know, we forget who our name is. So, but this is just the right amount, and I do appreciate it. I'm not leaving that here. I'm taking it with me.
I also delivered a little more entertaining, I think, than we anticipated by the Department of Law.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jesus. He made me this way.